Hi everyone, it's time again for the Retro Computing Roundtable. This is the show of vintage computer news, views, and auctions with your favorite panelists within the community of computer history and nostalgia.
Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
This is show 6, and I am your humble host, David Grillish of ClassicComputing.com. I have a blog, and I produce 2 other podcasts, the Classic Computing Show video podcast, and Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast. I'm in the greater Atlanta area, Johns Creek, Georgia, which, if anybody is interested, is about 30 miles due north of Midtown Atlanta. And it is a beautiful day here, by the way, as I look out the window next to my desk. I mean, it is beautiful, just clear blue skies, the sun is bright. I think it's like lower 50s or something, which is, you know, pretty mild for right now. So anyway, if everyone's ready, we're going to all belly up now around the virtual table and get started. First, we have a returning panelist, Carrington Vanston, which, Carrington, I think you were on the first show.
I was in one show. I think it was the first one, yeah.
And then you couldn't make it, I think, to the last show. You got tied up in an airport, mm-hmm. and we got Derek in last minute. So you're in Toronto, Canada.
I am indeed, yes.
Now you host your own podcast, the 1 Megahertz, the Apple II podcast.
Yep.
Which goes back to 2006. And it's unique because you do hands-on reviews of games, which is good.
I do, yeah. I try to look at old Apple II technology, but with a sort of with a modern view, not reviewing it just because it was good at the time. See if I actually – mostly it's games, and I'll see if I actually enjoy them, you know, given that we live in a PlayStation 3 world now.
Right, and I think one thing that's really there's other podcasts and like YouTube shows about game reviews and stuff, but yours is an audio podcast, and I think it's unique because it's really you really do a great job considering it's only audio.
Yeah, I struggle with that at the very beginning, thinking how am I going to describe something that is primarily a video in audio only, but it's fun to do.
So welcome back. What's new with you?
The same old, lots of writing, back to blogging. I do another podcast as well, but it's not computer related.
Go ahead and mention it.
It's called Double Take. A friend of mine, Sherry, we have zip.ca accounts, which is sort of like the Canadian equivalent of a Netflix DVD account. But she's in control of my list and I'm in control of hers. So we don't know what's going to show up in the envelopes. We sort of assign each other movies to watch each week that way. And then at the end of each show, rip open our envelopes and see what we have to watch for the next episode. It's fun.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I've been a movie buff since way, way, way back, and she and I have very, very different tastes in films. So it's interesting to see what she'll assign for me and vice versa.
Well, I'm glad you're back on.
Me too.
Thanks. And so next we have Michael Nadeau, and he's from Salem, New Hampshire.
Hello, David.
Hey, and good morning. He is the author of Collectible Microcomputers, and you write the Classic Tech blog. What's new with you?
Well, shoveling snow lately, I'm plugging away at the blog, trying to turn it into a reference for all things computer related. I'm slowly been adding listings for new systems, talking about what they are, the specs, and a little bit about the companies behind them too.
You guys got dumped on, pretty much. It was the South 3 weeks ago when I did the last show. Because Atlanta, I didn't go to work for 4 days, and I live in the Atlanta area because of snow. So yeah, you guys have been getting it?
Yeah, next week will be the third week in a row where we've had a 2-day storm.
Us Canadians have no sympathy for any of you. Just thought I'd mention that.
So thanks, Michael, for being back on. It's good to have you and see you again. So now we have Bruce Damer, and Bruce calls the Ancient Oaks Farm his home, which is a 19th century farmstead nestled deep in the Santa Cruz Mountains of Northern California. Kind of what city, I guess, is that near, Bruce?
We're between Santa Cruz and Los Gatos, Cupertino. So we're 25 minutes from Apple headquarters, actually.
So is it correct to say you're in the greater Silicon Valley area?
Yep.
Okay. And you're the curator of the DigiBarn Computer Museum, which is literally inside a very old barn, I think. On your webpage, is it 90 plus years old, the barn?
Yep.
I've met you before at a vintage computer festival, and I know of you and have read your webpage a few times. You've had some podcasts in the past, some video features. I was reading up on you, of course, for your first time on the show. So you worked for NASA, is that right? At Ames?
Yeah. Yep. For about 10 years, I led a team that did 3D visualization of missions and simulation and design of new missions for NASA.
Okay.
And now I'm working on a project in simulation in chemistry called the Evolution Grid, which is designed to create a large grid of chemical simulation computers to look at the origin of life question.
Wow. So that is that. So that's your real job, I guess, other than being the DigiBarn and the museum and everything?
That's
forgive that term.
That's my day job, and I'm
day job, okay.
I'm CTO of a company I helped start in the 80s, and a couple of other projects going on. But the DigiBarn is sort of the love at home kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's great. And there's a lot of great information on Bruce's site, and a lot of things him and his wife have done, you know, and the DigiBarn has done over the years. And you've got like a big collection of altos from Xerox PARC and just tons of stuff there.
In fact, the project started as a way to tell the story of Xerox, and then it just went from there and became the story of all personal interactive computing.
Which happens when you start collecting stuff.
Yep.
Just as an aside, I worked at a NASA center too, me and my wife both, for 4.5 years. So on the East Coast, NASA Langley in Hampton, Virginia.
Gotcha.
Which, you know, was the very first NASA center. I don't know if you knew that.
I think it was.
Yeah, it was. It started as a NACA center, and I don't remember all the history, but I know one of the Wright brothers had something to do with it. So, you know, NACA was very instrumental in the evolution of the wing design, and so that center was very important there, and wind tunnel testing and stuff. So I'm in IT, so I wasn't doing any research or anything like that, just fixing people's computers. But it was a very interesting, you know, really cool place to work. I really liked working there. Thanks for being on the show. So what I've been doing lately is messing around with a bunch of Macs in my dining room, which is filled up right now. So since I've been pulling them out of the garage, just because you got to do that sort of thing once in a while and see if they power up and work, and I'm just kind of going through them. I found my original Mac Classic apparently has a bad power supply because it just frizzles and frazzles and blinks the screen and doesn't do anything. Some other stuff I've been doing recently is I discovered two new podcasts that I wanted to tell everyone about. One is called, and let me know if you've heard of these, one is called Matt Chat. The Matt Chat?
Sure, yeah.
Maybe, Carrington, you've heard of this one?
Yes, I have.
His name is Matt Barton. And just been a great, you know, I'm not a big gamer. I mean, I never really have been a big gamer, but, you know, I've enjoyed some games over the years. So, it's, you know, he reviews games. This is a video one, and he does screenshots while he's talking about it, you know, video of them. So I've listened to some of his older ones. And so his recent one was 90. I guess more recently in his show, he started interviewing people. So his current one, Matt Chat 90, is with about Wasteland and Fallout with Brian Fargo. I just think the interviews are just really fascinating. It's just it really inspires me as a podcaster. As I do try to do more interviews, I try to do a video one like he's doing, which, you know, it's just you're looking at them talking. It's not anything that exciting about the video, but anyway, it's a great podcast. I've enjoyed it. Another one is a recent one I've discovered called The Retroist. Has anyone heard of that one?
Yeah, I follow him on Twitter.
Okay, yeah, he tweets a lot. I sort of wonder, does he have a day job? Now, he's all things kind of retro, you know, so not just, obviously not just computer stuff. And I've gone back, started listening to some of his earlier podcasts. There's been a few I've skipped because they didn't interest me. I think the large majority I'm listening to. So, like, recently I listened to one about The Game of Life, The Game of Monopoly, the Back to the Future movies. He also, I think this is an earlier one, he did one on the Atari 5200. Yeah, so he does computer and gaming related things as well. One thing I really like about him, and I can't think what his name is, but he seems to start off his podcast with a story, and it's just really good entertainment. Great to listen to. So that's what I've been up to, as well as I am trying to launch the Historical Computer Society, which is what I had called my original group back in 1993. I wanted to start a user group. It wasn't local though, and I started a newsletter. Dan Veet was one of my first members. So anyway, here in the greater Atlanta area, I'm trying to start up an actual user group, and my intent is to make it a self-governing, nonprofit organization, sort of a traditional user group, and hopefully start an expo here in the greater Atlanta area. So I kind of started to do it a few months ago at my job, and I just don't think the venue was right. So now I've kind of stepped it back and created a discussion group and kind of moving slower and to get a few solid people sort of involve first before we find a proper venue for meetings and then move on from there. Anyway, so I'll have a link in the show. Anyone's welcome to join the discussion group, but obviously the intent is to have meetings in the greater Atlanta area. Lastly, in my what I'm up to is, so next Saturday I'm going to be interviewing Salam. Bruce, have you spoken to him recently?
Just by email, but he seems to be very happy. He's working on a number of expert witness type patent cases, so he was back east, I think, recently.
I believe so, yeah. I know he's very busy with Vintage Tech, so that's what he spends a lot of his time doing. But so Salam is the original founder and the organizer of the original Vintage Computer Festival, the ones in, you know, California. And I'm not sure where they started originally, but then for a lot of years there, they were in Mountain View at the Computer History Museum. And I guess the last one, if I'm not mistaken, was in like 2008, 7 or 8, so there hasn't been one. So in any case, I'm going to be interviewing him next week, and hopefully we'll get some inside information about maybe the future of, you know, Vintage Computer Festivals in California and what's going on. And I know just maybe he might be able to make it to the Vintage Computer Festival East, which is in May. So let's get started. We have a number of good news and items here to discuss. And the first one we're going to talk about is 25 years of digital vandalism. This is something in the New York Times here. And Michael, you tweeted this about this article. Yes. So maybe you can start us off on kind of what it's about.
Well, it was written by William Gibson, who obviously is the famous cyberpunk author. And he's just musing on the fact that 25 years ago, the first PC virus was released by two brothers in Pakistan inadvertently. It was originally a DRM device to protect their software, but it had a nasty habit of freezing up people's computers when it ran. And what was interesting is it got beyond the software it was trying to protect and got out into the general population, spread by floppies. And The funny thing about it is that they included their phone numbers when your computer froze. So they got calls from around the world after people lost their computers. But he ties it into the more recent event with the Stuxnet virus, which brought down the Iranian centrifuges.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just interesting. The point he was making was that he thought that, you know, the Stuxnet virus would be much more advanced, and when in fact it was really not that much more advanced than what the Alvi brothers did in Pakistan.
One thing interesting about this story is, you know, how it seems like I don't know if it's happened in real life, but, you know, in science fiction movies, you know, with real viruses, this whole storyline of, you know, the scientists are working with this virus or something, and somehow it gets out into the real world. what was that one movie with like Dustin Hoffman about the monkey and the virus? And you guys remember that?
Yeah,
I know I don't remember the name of it.
Yeah, but, yeah. Doesn't it kind of make you think of that a little bit? But obviously, in the virtual sense, in a computer virus, but, you know, it got out.
I think one of Gibson's points was that he was surprised before and still that these things are often not the results of incredible giant efforts and money and stuff, but rather just like it says in the title, just some small acts of vandalism, that often these things have their starts just in somebody who just wants to see if they can do it, or it's really no different than a digital version of spray painting on the side of a wall, and often the impetus is nothing greater than that.
I think I've only been the victim of a true virus one time in my life. I mean, other than more recently with spyware, which, you know, was a nuisance, but it didn't destroy anything. And even the one virus that I got, and this is 20 years ago, so this is like the only one I know of that really did any damage on Macintoshes. It would destroy or mess up the desktop file, and I don't remember what it was called now, but you simply, you know, in the OS 7 days or whatever, 6, you just rebuild the desktop and that would fix it for the most part.
You know, I think also the first internet worm, wasn't that from like 1983 or 4, that Cornell student? So it's a virus of the network type that came out a few years before this, the one on the PC.
That was the Morris worm.
Right.
And I think it was a little bit later. But yeah, that was an accident too. the guy who was experimenting with certain types of programs, and it for some reason it got out. I don't remember the details.
Yeah, this brings us, in, at least in the Wikipedia article on Computer Worm, this brings us into back to Xerox PARC here, about beginning with the very first research into worms at Xerox PARC. There have been attempts to create useful worms, and then dangerous worms, and then, you know, history. Anyway, more about that.
One point, the first worm, I believe it was going around PARC's internal Ethernet checking for failed memory on the Altos.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you came in the morning, you could tell which machines weren't going to work properly.
What is it called? So it was really just kind of a worm, but it was like a program is all it is, really. Just a program that could replicate and just keep running to do useful things in a lot of cases. And then people.
But then it gets out of hand. Yeah, the Stuxnet one, though, I think is comprised of both a rootkit and a worm. One thing I found interesting about Gibson's article, or rather what something I found interesting that wasn't really in Gibson's article, was what was mentioned before, that he's tying together the origin of something that was essentially the beginnings of DRM and the way it functioned with the Stuxnet worm and current viruses and that sort of thing. But what he doesn't really go into, or doesn't mention at all in this very brief article, is that DRM stuff is still around, and this is the origins of DRM that had unforeseen consequences and was really annoying for everybody involved, and pretty much it's the exact same situation now with DRM, which is itself at its root, something injected into some other content and then often has unforeseen consequences, both for the person injecting it and the people who are trying to use that content. Now, maybe it's the case that since this appeared in the New York Times, the lover of all things paywall, no editor there would want to have an article that talked about how we're still in that same mess with people trying to use these same technologies. But I found it interesting, or maybe it was the case that as an author, he's more pro-DRM than some other people or something. It's just sort of interesting that he brings that up, but then doesn't really delve into what I think the more obvious connection just to current DRM standards.
Right. Yeah, very interesting. I'm going to move along to the Vintage Computer Festival East. It is set for May 14th and 15th, which is a Saturday and a Sunday. It's at the InfoAge Science Center. And that's also where the organization that organizes the Vintage Computer Festival East, March, Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists, that's where they have a museum, as well as it's a radio museum, and it's a historic United States Army facility. It's something that Marconi did research there early on. So I'm going to be going to that, so that's a definite, and I'm going to do a small display. And plus, we're going to be doing a RCR podcast live from there.
That's very cool.
Yeah, and I don't know if we can actually, I say live, I don't know if we can like have it streaming. I would like that to happen, as well as video. But certainly, we can at least record the video of the podcast, if nothing else, and after the fact. But definitely, we're going to do one from there.
That's very exciting. I've wanted to go to a VCF since I first heard about them, and of course the ones on the east are the easiest for me to get to, being in Toronto, but I have yet to attend, so I'm quite excited that another east one has been announced.
Well, please try to go. So this is the end of January, so you got February, March, April, so you have 3.5 months to try to go.
That's awesome.
I don't, how far would that be driving distance for you?
Oh, I don't know. Everywhere is driving distance if you have enough time, so... I guess everywhere is walking distance if you have enough time.
But I'm going to start, mentioning the VCF East, every show, just kind of let remind everybody about it. Hopefully this could be the biggest one yet, and I'm real excited about my participation in it as well as just a fun thing to do. And there's lots of good displays and speakers and everything else. But one other item I have in regard to this, I'd put in our show notes that us panelists see, is about a controversy that arose in the last day or so. And it's not really a controversy per se, but in the vintage-computer.com forums, they were discussing the Vintage Computer Festival East. This is in the last, I guess, week or so. And people are talking about it. And then a person made a post and they said, it would be great fun to have a 486 LAN party whilst there. I love those old games. And then Evan Koplitz, who's one of our panelists and also the president of March and one of the organizers, he says, please tell me you are joking. At the Vintage Computer Festival events, you won't find anything newer than a 186. And so some people had some different comments, and I'm not going to read all of them, but here's one that kind of stands out, this other person. Basically, some people were making arguments about, you know, why aren't 386s or 486s involved? And it's funny because this has been sort of a debate that's been going on for a lot of years. When the first classic computing discussion list started, like 97, people were discussing this. And should anything newer than 10 years be accepted, or 15 years? And so let me read real quick what this one person said. And I noticed he is now banned from the group. He wrote this at 8:36 a.m. yesterday, and now it says his name, he's banned. He says, "I'd probably not think of anything you'd consider vintage as vintage. I'd call them ancient, quote-unquote. For example, S100 systems. I can see that they're strange beasts, perhaps worthy of dissection and study, but I have no idea why you guys would collect machines that can hardly do anything, often have no screens or keyboards, and aren't really even standardized, and, you know, blah, blah, blah."
Well, that's just clear trolling.
Right, right. And some people said, like, why are you, you know, this is borderline trolling what you're saying here. Anyway, I thought it was kind of funny and interesting. So
it does bring up an interesting idea, though, that what is retro? What is vintage? Mm-hmm. Probably it's one of those things that everybody has their own personal definition or so. Mm-hmm. But it is an interesting topic, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, the term retros, is that short for a longer word now I'm thinking about it?
Probably just retrospective.
Retrospective. Okay. Thank you. Well, you know what? Maybe another term would be nostalgic. Something that is nostalgic, it doesn't have, who knows how old it is. I guess it's just not around anymore. That's why you're nostalgic about it.
It's sure, not and part I think a lot of people do anymore. Have sort of a rolling thing, like anything older than X number of years is considered retro or vintage or what have you. Same thing with vintage clothing, vintage cars, or whatever. And I guess it's got to be a personal thing. Like I grew up in the 8-bit era and before that, but to my nephew who turned 14 yesterday, I'm sure a PlayStation 1 is completely retro and vintage and remarkable.
And Bill Degnan, who's also, you know, a panelist on this show, and he's the vice president of March and, you know, co-coordinator, organizer of the VCF East. But he kind of closes this out, at least as of yesterday, before anyone posts anymore, that I think he handles it really well. Staying home because you feel snubbed because your 486 is not considered special, quote, yet anyway, or bracketed, is a shame. You're missing out on a great event. I believe that an event like VCF puts the late 80s, early 90s stuff in perspective. The original VCS discouraged computers from before 1983. Slowly, this boundary is being pushed forward. This forum, in my opinion, is too liberal about what is quote-unquote vintage. But do your own thing. Hold a 386 to Pentium era event sometime. I would go. In short, patience my Padawan apprentice.
That's a pretty funny last comment, because when you first brought up the topic, I was thinking, well, I can... Well, for me, my definitions of retro are very vague and swimmy all over the place. And frankly, if I went to VCF and there was somewhere in the hallways a 486 gaming convention, I would probably dive right in and say, sure, whatever. But I can see how other people would take the, you know, don't wear a Wookiee costume to a Star Trek convention idea and say there's a place for things. I get it. For me personally, I guess vintage is just sort of any technology I played with before I had a girlfriend. Bingo. There you go. So it's not much of a sliding scale, but I guess everybody's got their own definition.
Well, I think because PCs dominated, or, you know, do dominate, have dominated for so long, especially, I'm going to throw a year out there, let's say, you know, solidly 20 years or more. I mean, with Windows 3.1 at least, and I'm just throwing stuff out there, that they all became very generic. There's so many of them. There's nothing really special about them per se, but there are exceptions. And I think in Windows, for instance, gaming, well, then you can bring up a game 10 years old, 15 years old, and it can be very retro or vintage in the fact of its gaming perspective, or, for instance, operating systems, Windows 3.1, OS 2, things like that that aren't, you know, maybe aren't vintage otherwise. But
sure, XP feels very vintage every time I have to use it, so things move. And I think you're right that there's probably categories of stuff. And there is, I can see that you could sort of lump in computers that ran Windows 3.1 with really computers running Windows 7. And maybe it's not until there's another dramatic paradigm shift in technology that you would consider that whole group vintage or something.
But I think, you know, Bill Degnan and Evan, you know, and the March people, they have a focus. And then the Vintage Computer Festival East has a focus. And I think that's perfectly reasonable and fine to kind of
keep it
niched in. Bruce, I was going to ask you, since you run a museum, what do you feel about this?
Well, Gordon Bell, who co-founded the Computer History Museum over the hill, he's been a big supporter of what we're doing here. And on a visit, we had a conversation about this, and he said, you know, it just goes to the generation, and there's the generation at the Computer History Museum. A lot of their trustees had, you know, grown up and imprinted like little ducklings on things like Burroughs, you know, mainframes mm-hmm. of the 50s and into the 60s. So they're very focused on those. But he said, you know, he actually wrote a paper, Gordon did, about this idea that people, that generations imprint on core, you know, mythical machines of their youth. And his argument for the new exhibit that just opened at the museum was they have to shift the thing forward. So in my advisement to the timeline, we cut it off. I mean, the groups that were designing it cut everything off around 1995, and they realized they had to do that because, you know, this exhibit is going to be around for, you know, 10, 15, you know, years in its current state. And if somebody brings their kids, they're going to get all excited about seeing Super Mario or
right.
or the first online Ultima Online or whatever, and they're going to want to see the first internet stuff. So it kind of finishes up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. And in 1995, obviously Windows 95 changed things a lot. The internet came on big right around that time. You know, if I find myself running a expo one day, it'll be an interesting sort of. I just think if you just maybe have some limits of what, you know, what would be displayed in a museum or a expo or whatever, you'd want to have kind of a nice crossover of everything. All right, we'll go back on a couple other things here. Let's see.
By the way, Steve Wozniak mm-hmm. was just here a couple of weeks ago, and he's very fixated on the late 70s, pretty much, you know, 1973 to... Well, the whole 70s, but the late 70s, and that's his world. It's the world of HP calculators and the world of the Apple I and II, and that's what he talks about.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's what he's kind of, he's the star of those years, you know, right? A lot of people want to know about that because that was, you know, he was at his peak, maybe. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and in fact, 5 years ago, we held the 30th birthday of the Homebrew Computer Club, mm-hmm. a big event, and was at the. He was on our panel, of course. He helped organize it, and he said, "The Homebrew Club was the best. They were the best times of my life." You know, and this is in 75. He's talking about before Apple started.
Wow,
that was an interesting statement. You know.
Yeah, I think all of us tend to look back on the past. Too, and maybe rose-colored glasses. Not to say they weren't the best times, or all of us don't look back at older times and think this was a great time. But you know, sometimes we all get older, and maybe things get more difficult or stressful, and so it's we sort of look back on those simpler times and maybe put them on a pedestal a little bit. But yeah, granted, Steve Wozniak, he accomplished a lot of stuff in the late 70s, and maybe came of age.
One of the things it was interesting is. It's hard to stump Woz on early systems, but we showed him this relatively new contribution to the museum, this 8008 microcomputer.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Gordon French had built an 8008 machine. Gordon French hosted the first homebrew club in his garage, club meeting. And we had Lee Felsenstein look at this system that came in. It was made at Sacramento State, Cal State Sacramento, in 1972, and it's a mind blower. It has an operating system in ROM, which we just dumped out part of. It supported a hard drive, a Tektronix color screen. It talked to a mainframe. It was a full-on microcomputer, probably the first one ever made. You know, I know this is a controversial thing in the history, but we're vetting this machine. It's 1972 and into early 73. Fully functional, and Woz looked at it and was like, oh my God, I never knew that something like this could be done back then. And look at all, but his second comment was telling, look at all the chips, look at all the cost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had an ASR33 on the side, it had a Tektronix 4223. The whole thing cost, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And there is the fundamentals of Woz's worldview. Mm-hmm. Do things with fewer chips. So he said, I never could have built something like this. I never would have tried. So that was something vintage for Woz, you know?
Yeah, with all the different, the boards are all laid out on the table there with the front panel in the picture there, right? With the video interviews.
Yeah, and there was a story a year ago on news.com where they came down with a reporter and a camera and did, you know, the whole controversy over the first micro. Mm-hmm. And there was a team here making a documentary there from Italy that's going to come out by the end of the year. It's called 8-Bit Micro, mm-hmm. and it's a five-part series. And Woz is one of the interviews, and I'm one of the interviews. And I showed them, you know, given that they're looking at 8-Bit Micros, that this is the first 8-Bit Micro. And you can see in the pictures the 8008 processor there, and it was early. It was shipped in March of or April of 72 to the university, and then the team there actually worked and built this machine around it, and it was a hellaciously hard project. But
will we be able to see that? Did you say it's coming out in Italy?
Yeah, I think it's going out into the worldwide market. There's so many documentary crews that come here, and I, you know, a couple of years later, I'll hear about how to see it or something. But some of them are on the History Channel and Discovery Channel or something like that, or BBC. But often they're independents, and mm-hmm. you never know when they're going to air.
All right, we'll see. We're going to move along. Let's see to the next article I had up is just about called a Truly Graphic Adventure, the 25-year rise and fall of a beloved genre, just about video games. Or computer games, I guess. It's a correct term.
Adventure games.
Adventure games, yep. And it starts off with The Wizard and the Princess, moves into the King Quest series. And interestingly, it goes in like a little bit further down. It goes to this game, Deja Vu, by Mac Venture. And I mentioned the Matt Chat podcast. So I just watched an older one for him, but where he covered this game. And I used to have this game as well as, what was the other one they did? Oh, The Uninvited, or just called Uninvited, which is very good. So I played that early on. But just some interesting stuff, you know, kind of overview of some different games.
Yeah, I love that entire genre of gaming. I mean, with the exception of the FMV, the full motion video games, because, you know, nobody loves those. But other than those...
Phantasmagoria and...
Yeah, I mean, I did play them all, and I guess Seventh Guest, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, early and late versions of these games just absolutely own my heart. I love them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Leisure Suit Larry and Maniac Mansion. Yeah, more recently, I guess, because of some of the other stuff I'm reading and watching, I've kind of gotten way more into, even though I didn't a lot of these I didn't play. I said I never was a big gaming person, but it's great to watch about them and learn about them, and, you know, so I get a lot out of it. I got maybe in some cases because I didn't play them. I don't know if that makes sense. Monkey Island, I think that's one you did, Carrington, isn't it? Did you cover Monkey Island one time?
Sure, yeah. I think I've...
The Secret of Monkey Island?
They sort of run together. It's hard for me to remember, but I don't know if I've put out the episode about the King's Quest games. I played that with a friend, so I've got a recording of us playing through the first one of those, her and I. But I don't think that one's live yet. I've done an episode about the Monkey Island one, so I don't know if that's actually been published yet.
Monkey Island 2. Maybe I'm confusing with the guy Matt Wilson, who does Boring Beige Box. I think he did some of those.
Sure, there. Yeah, and the Lucas ones as well. I'm a huge fan of. In this article, it mentions Jordan Mirchner's one, the Last Express, which is a game that I didn't actually finish and had sort of completely forgotten about. It was a game I was playing on the Mac years and years and years ago, absolutely loving, and then had a system switch or something. And then I guess just dropped the game. So I was happy to read the article because it reminded me I have unfinished business on the Last Express. So I think I'm gonna play that one through. So I like his games. He's the guy that was behind Karateka and then Prince of Persia, and subsequently has become a I guess Jordan Mirchner is now a screenwriter because he was either the sole writer or one of the writers on the Prince of Persia movie. So I think that's what he's doing now.
Basically, the article winds up because it's talking about the rise and the fall. So essentially, and it does mention, looks like it has Phantasmagoria in here. Yeah, so like Carrington, what you mentioned, a lot of these games try to get into having, you know, full motion video into them, which worked and didn't work in a lot of ways. I think Seventh Guest was very successful, and Phantasmagoria was actually controversial, and they talk about this in the, it was kind of a hard, you know, sort of had some grotesque scenes to a certain extent. But basically, what killed the adventure genre was the first-person shooter. So I guess what rose out of the 90s, especially to the late 90s, was Doom, right? Doom and Wolfenstein 3D in the early 90s, and then Doom, and then Quake, and so on.
Oh, sure. And
which kind of killed the whole...
Yeah, I don't know to say if it killed them is accurate, though. I mean, it certainly took the focus away from that type of genre in games. The majority of people playing computerized games went on to do first-person shooters and that sort of thing. But adventure games are still around in the same way. I mean, text adventures are still around in a sense. But I think there's been quite a resurgence now that there's such great touch platforms. I mean, these sorts of games are starting to sell quite well on things like iPhones and iPads. And some of the games mentioned even in the article are selling very well right now on the iPad as games and things. And so, you know, they do stay around. I buy them currently and play them. I enjoy them quite a bit.
Yeah, probably too strong a word to say killed. How about, I guess they moved out
named?
Of the, they moved out of the focus, the main focus of games, I guess. You know, the obviously first-person shooters sort of dominate. All right, moving on. The next item we have to discuss is about this film that came out just a little over a week ago by IBM celebrating their 100 years. So it's called the IBM Centennial Film, A Century of Achievements That Have Changed the World. Have all of you had a chance to see that?
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
Michael, what did you have any comments about this?
Well, it was obviously a feel-good film for IBM.
Yeah.
It was very well done. You know, I know a number of people who have seen this outside of the hobby, and everybody's blown away by it.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually learned some things from it. I didn't know IBM invented barcodes.
So, no,
yeah,
me
I didn't know that either.
13 minutes, and it's very enjoyable, very well done, and I highly recommend anybody to watch it.
I was born 100 years ago, 1911. Another important thing happened that year. Three companies took a bold step and created the Computing, Tabulating, Recording Company. And the world was about to get a whole lot smarter.
By 1912, the year I was born, the company already has 1,300 employees.
1913, the company's Hollerith tabulating machine.
Certainly a PR thing.
Yeah, what impressed me, too, is they had some of those early employees still pretty lucid after 100 or so years.
Mm-hmm. They at least had one guy, I think, he said he was 100, didn't he? Mm-hmm. He was born in 1911. And
yes.
And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I mean, yeah, it's obviously IBM propaganda or whatever, but it was such a great way to sort of celebrate the 100 years and to put it in perspective, and such a neat idea to have it go from people that are 100 down to people that are just about to be born and them talking about what happened in the year of their birth. Very, very interesting. I wasn't very happy with the one for my year, 1968, because I guess IBM didn't really do much that year because it just – I think it was just said that their collaboration with the space program was converging on the ultimate goal. So like, so that's all you had was next year we'll do something cool. So, oh well.
I couldn't help myself, but as I was watching it, especially when they got up into, I guess it was in the mid-30s or, you know, around 40s or whatever, it was pre-World War II just slightly, but they had like someone from Japan and a couple other countries. You know, it's a long video, has a lot of segments, but I have a book that is kind of another topic that's creeped in. It's called IBM and the Holocaust.
I was going to say that on YouTube, the comments are about 50% about how, oh, you skipped over all the stuff about Germany.
Oh, really? I had not even looked at any of the comments. And usually I always look at comments. Yeah. And so it's a controversial subject that, you know, the author of this book, Edwin Black, pretty much his main premise is that because of Hollerith tabulating machines made the records of the Jews and everybody all possible to round them up, and you know, for, and that IBM continued to do business with Germany and throughout the entire Second World War. I will say in their defense, Thomas Watson Senior, I'm pretty sure it was Senior at that point. You know, he did receive a medal from Hitler, which he then returned sometime, I think, around the mid 40s or whatever. You know, this kind of show disdain or whatever. But anyway, else have any more comments on that?
I liked my favorite line was, I think it was 31. We're talking about 1931, where he talked about all the very various punches and said 31 was a big year for punches.
Mm. Yeah.
So I like that as a line. My favorite, I had noted down that my favorite year, the one I found most interesting was 1983, because I mean, it's well into a year where I was interested in technology and right on the birth of Apple's 1984 commercial. So we're into the years of, you know, Big Blue and the idea of personal computers should be different than maybe IBM's vision and stuff. And it talked about how in 83, IBM introduced System 36, mm-hmm. which even in this film, which is, you know, a up with IBM sort of film, talk about how it was an easy to use business computer featuring 2,800 help screens. And I thought, okay, well, there were people in the 80s thinking the problem with technology is it requires 2,800 help screens. So I found that very interesting.
So with this centennial celebration of IBM, it made me think about the other thing that's happened recently, and I'm not sure when it airs, the machine called the IBM Watson machine on Jeopardy. Does anyone know?
No, I know that Watson won the pregame. Like, they did a test run, and Watson won that one. But that's as far as I know. That's all I've heard so far. And I don't think they've actually aired the actual episode. They'll probably hide who the winner of that is until it broadcasts, I assume.
So I put a link to a YouTube video by IBM as well. Looks like it was put out around the same time, called IBM Watson, a System Designed for Answers. And it's very interesting about this computer that has AI and goes up between the two highest winning are champions of Jeopardy.
If you really think what's involved in a computer listening to a Jeopardy style answer and having to parse that and think about it and come up with the question that it and feel strong enough that it's willing to buzz in, because I don't know Jeopardy very well, but I guess you lose the money if you buzz in and are incorrect. To program a computer that can do that in real time is a remarkable feat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's also sort of interesting. I wonder if we just keep pushing back. We start with the idea that, a Turing test, if you can fool somebody on the other end of a modem to think you're human or half of them are human, then that's enough. And now we're like, you know what? No, you got to win Jeopardy. I think we're just trying to avoid the Skynet.
So I'm going to move along to this article about the debate. Or Michael, you had brought this up, a debate over the Jane Smiley, and I can never say his name right, Antanasoff? And I believe this is something that we discussed on an earlier podcast with Evan. I think it was brought up, but go ahead.
Right. Well, Evan's involved in the website theENIAC.com, which is I believe the Mockley family, one of the builders of the ENIAC. That's their site. And there's a controversy over who built the first electronic computer. Smiley's argument is that it was Antanasoff who did it, and in fact, there's a court case that where he won against the ENIAC, and they said that he's the inventor of the computer. But it's become a very emotional argument on both sides. But to me, it's all semantics, because it appears that nobody disagrees over the facts, and it all boils down to the definition of a computer. And the ENIAC people are saying that the ENIAC was first because it had stored programs, and that the ABC computer did not. But to me, it just detracts from both accomplishments. The controversy detracts from both accomplishments. It diminishes them. Each side is trying to bring the other down a peg.
Mm-hmm.
I've been tracking this too, and in fact, had an email from Bill Mockley, the son of the Mockley Sr., because there was a talk on Thursday night, of course, by the author of the controversial book. I guess she's the granddaughter of Antanasoff. There was an onstage talk with her at the Computer History Museum 2 nights ago.
I think, Bruce, she has some connection with is it the Ohio State University, or is the university where Antanasoff?
Iowa.
Iowa.
Yeah, so there's her connection is something with that. Yeah.
Well, you know, I've been doing a little bit of research on this. A couple of years ago, I went to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, where I'm occasionally a visitor with a member there named Pete Hott. And Freeman Dyson's son, and I'd been in contact, and I'd been in contact with Freeman, and I asked George Dyson, I said, is there any way that I can go over to the archive and look up the electronic computer project, von Neumann's computer project? And he introduced me to them and went over there. I spent the day going through stuff. I was looking for the artificial life program that ran on von Neumann's machine, found the punch cards and did a lot of documentation. But I read all the letters that were written by Oppenheimer and von Neumann around the project, because the letters really, really document it. And then this year I was asked to write a piece on the very question of, and this was from a British researcher, Peter Bentley, who's doing a book on the birth of computing in the United Kingdom. And so he said, would you write me a piece of an argument where you think, you know, quote unquote, the first computer came? Did it come from our shores here in the UK, the Manchester Mark II and whatever, or did it come from across the pond in the United States? And I did a lot of thinking about this, and I thought, well, there's so many bits and pieces that were firsts, you know, the first conceptual, first theoretical pieces, you know, Alan Turing and company. But after reviewing all of the von Neumann electronic computer at Princeton documentation, and also the how it spread, how the meme spread, because they purposely didn't patent anything, and they purposefully shared their designs in these reports with anyone who, the Army wanted this too, with anyone who wanted to build an electronic computer. So people started building copies of, you know, Johnny von Neumann's machine. And to me, and I wrote this argument that I think the first complete modern computer with a backing storage, with all the I.O. devices, with all the software internal, with all these characteristics, with the performance you needed to write sophisticated programs, it had to be the ECP machine, the Princeton machine, in my opinion. And the fact that so many groups copied that design on, you know, purposefully. So you couldn't say that it was the first computer, but you could say it was the first fully formed modern computer, like our 8008 Micro, maybe the first fully formed microcomputer, because it had all the components in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's always a debate. I mean, even like, you know, right, what's the first personal computer? I guess these are the two biggest debates of computer systems, as far as the first computer and the first personal computer.
And that one, that also rages, and a story on that. The Link, I don't know if you guys know about the Link from 1962? From Lincoln Labs,
I've heard of it before. Yes. I don't know a lot about it.
Well, the about 5 years ago, I had a visit from a fellow named Severo Ornstein to the museum. Nice tour, and he said, "Well, you're talking about the birth of personal computing, but you don't have anything referring to the Link." And I remembered it from college textbooks. And he said, "Well, I'm the hardware designer of the Link, and I can introduce you to Wes Clark, who's the, you know, the overall visionary behind that, and the computer called the TX0, TX2 at Lincoln Labs." It turns out, you know, that they found one of the team members had four of them in his garage in St. Louis, restored one, trucked it out here. Gordon Bell helped on the project, and now it sits in the Digi Barn, and it boots up and runs.
Wow.
And it's from the year of my birth, 1962. Here I am dating myself. But it was considered by Alan Kay, by Gordon Bell, by many people to be the first machine in which the experience of personal computing was possible, in that there was a screen, there was a keyboard, it was all your machine, you turned it off at night, there were four modules in a refrigerator sized cabinet, but mm-hmm. you know, it was large, it was movable in a vehicle. It was used in private homes. A couple of the researchers took them home and wrote the operating system. They're sitting there in their living rooms in the mid-60s. They were homebrewed. They were made from parts. So it was fun. It was a laboratory instrument computer. It was for research in the lab. But and they exchanged software on these little miniature tapes that ended up becoming deck tape. And the PDP-11 series came out of them. the very design of the first router for the internet, or router, as Canadians or Americans would say. I'm Canadian, by the way, originally. If you
woohoo.
Can't tell.
That's right. Carrington's Canadian.
Yeah. Go Canucks.
Go Canucks. So the link, I mean, and to top it all off, you know, there's a big controversy around this machine, around its inclusion in the timeline. And there, lo and behold, after all this effort and us holding a big, big event with 300 people in 2007 at the last VCF, there in the timeline in the Computer History Museum is the link. And the placard is this the first personal computer? You know, so the questions go on, but we moved the target. We moved the pointer back from about 1970-something or other to 1962. And everyone's pretty thrilled that the link is finally getting its due.
And, you know, sometimes it comes down to a battle of semantics and words. And so the term personal is pretty clear, personal, to be used by one person. But I guess a lot of people, and myself included, I tend to think of, you know, the term itself, a personal computer, which of course was a microcomputer before, was so maybe a better term would be, or a question would be, what was the first consumer computer? You know, mm-hmm. in other words, a computer that a regular person could purchase and then use. So maybe a lot of us confuse that, you know, that term, personal computer, as with,
yes,
you know,
with
consumer.
That. And right. that might have been the Sol 20, mm-hmm. frankly, 76. You know, they sold 10,000 of them. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then for that matter, too, I have to say that, like in some presentations I've given, kind of bending that even more, because I think you're absolutely right. But I guess what I tend to consider is the first true consumer computers, because, again, defining it as what I define as what regular people would buy, not hobbyists, you know, would be the Commodore PET, the Apple II, and the TRS-80 Model 1. You know, these were obviously controversial. In my opinion, these are the first three computers where regular old people that don't know anything about computers, you know, could just walk in a store, buy a box, go home, you know, and essentially open it up, set it up, and do something with it. But even that's debatable, that you could do something with it, right?
Although the Sol was definitely predated those by a year, and people ran electric pencil and
absolutely
all kinds of things on it.
It wasn't necessarily harder to use either.
It was, you know, slightly clunkier. I mean, certainly the fine packaging of those three 1977 machines did suggest consumer, whereas the Sol was a little on the heavy side and a little bit on the clunky side. But you know, ordinary human beings were able to use them for some things.
Right.
Which is more than can be said for things like the Sinclair ZX81 I had a number of years later, so.
You couldn't do much with it, huh?
No.
By the way, in honor of Stan Veit, mm-hmm. I just wanted to let you know that one of the things in the collection, Stan, you know, as we know, you'll explain who Stan Veit is for the listener audience, but Stan sent a big box of all kinds of things, badges, T-shirts, here years ago, and one of them is this wonderful T-shirt. It says, Personal Computing 76, Atlanta City, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And it, according to Stan, and we've got the photos to prove it, it was the first personal computer trade show, and Stan donated a table to three guys who, as long as they could get their way out there from California,
right?
He would allow them to give them a free table and let them show off their computer called the Apple I. And of course, it was Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, and Daniel Kottke.
Mm-hmm.
And that T-shirt now hangs in the Digi Barn, and I believe it was what Stan was wearing. And so it's amazing, and it's signed. The T-shirt is signed by Daniel Kottke and Steve Wozniak. It's not signed yet by Mr. Jobs, and may never be. But just a wonderful memorial to this tremendous figure in personal computing history.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you for that. And obviously, I'm a big fan of Stan's, and I got to actually even meet him in person a couple of times. And you know, he's very supportive of me. I first met Stan when I was in the military, and I was still stationed in Germany. So I was in another country, but I'd got online for the first time on CompuServe. And so he was in the CompuServe, you know, different forums. It's been such a long time. I think it was a computer history related forum. But that's when I first got the idea of collecting computers and starting a club when I got back to the States. And so I went back and forth some emails with him. And then once I got to the States, I started a newsletter, and he was sent me a check for a subscription and a copy of his book, you know, for me to a review copy.
And so
I started a relationship with him that was just really great. You know, I would always buy the Computer Shopper magazine and read his Whatever Happened To column. I'm finishing up chapter 4 of the book, and then chapter 5, I don't have a copyright on hand here, but if I'm not mistaken, chapter 5 has that story in it about that computer show. And, I should know this by heart, but it wasn't Stan's wife. I think it was his mother-in-law who insisted that Steve Jobs take his pants off and let her mend the hole in the pants at that show.
that show.
Yeah, it's a great story.
There was a hole in Steve Jobs' pants.
Yeah. So that's in that chapter. So
it's too bad you don't have the pants hanging up by the T-shirt.
Oh, by the way, just so you know, I have a back pocket of a Levi's jean from it's on loan from Daniel Kottke, and it was the very pair of Levi's that he wore when he worked in the Apple garage in June of 76 assembling Apple Ones.
Wow.
This is a piece of denim of great note in computer
history.
This
is the 21st century version of pieces of saints and things. We're now going to have
the finger of the saint. Yeah. The threads from the Buddha, you know. So this pocket would have sat on a bench, you know, while he was soldering these machines together.
I have a copy. You know, I have the copy I read from, and this is my advanced uncorrected proof copy of Stan's book. So it's the next chapter, chapter 5, the early days of Apple Computer. So since it was brought up, let's see, here's the part. So this is when Steve Jobs and Dan Kottke and Woz has shown up and everything, and it says, at this point, my mother-in-law came over to Steve. She looked him up and down and said, "Young man, your backside is sticking out of holes in those jeans. You are not going to be in my booth like that. Take them off and I'll sew them up now." Steve Jobs was more than a little surprised. I don't think anyone had ever spoken to him like that. However, you didn't fool around with Elizabeth Olivet, who was a very formidable Italian grandmother. Steve went behind a curtain, took off his pants, and handed them to her. She took out the sewing kit from her commodious bag and mended the worn jeans until they met her standards of modesty. All Jobs said was, "Thanks. I think we better get back to the room to see how Woz is doing." Oh, because he was in a back room working on, I guess, BASIC. Finishing up BASIC.
Getting things working, yeah. I guess this is before the black turtleneck period.
Yeah. All right, the last item I'm going to mention is, and this just got tweeted out yesterday, there's a great online, and you can download it, PDF free magazine called Commodore Free, and they just released issue 47, so there's a link in the notes there. So it's kind of cool. There's still a Commodore magazine being published, and it's free.
That is cool, but for those of us on the Apple side of the Commodore's awful Apple is good war, I prefer juiced.js, the Apple version of that, which is actually printed and sent out. I just renewed my subscription. So,
you know, and
Apple
I've been meaning
forever.
To subscribe to it. And Ken Gagne, who runs the Kansas Fest, publishes that. And
is an amazing fellow, like such a good guy.
Mm-hmm. He is. And I'm really hoping, you know, I've definitely committed to going to the VCF East, and I really want to go to Kansas Fest. So I can't say I'm 100% committed that I can go. I think so, though, so I'm really trying to go to that this year.
I have been to one Kansas Fest, which is...
I followed you on that, and you bought a little motorcycle thing.
I went down on a Vespa, yes, from Toronto to Kansas City, Missouri, and back on a Vespa to go to Kansas Fest, and a completely fantastic experience. It was just... I cannot believe I haven't gone back because it was just beginning to end incredible.
Well, Carrington, try to make it either to VCF East or Kansas Fest so we can hang out.
Yeah, I'd love to do both, actually. Yeah, I really want to go back to Kansas Fest. Every year I kick myself for not going, and I've been dying to go to a VCF for ages, so I'd like to make that this year as well.
Now we're going to move in about eBay auctions, so I'm going to quickly just go over last time around. The first one was by Derek Warren, and it was Task Tines and Tonetown. And you know what? I have a copy of this game for the 2GS, just the discs, that worked, but I could kick myself why I didn't go ahead and try to buy this, because it sold for $15.
Oh, that's a good price for that if it was a complete copy. Yeah.
Yeah, really good. Right, it was a complete copy.
And that is a great game.
Right, and you covered that in your first podcast?
Did I? Oh, okay. Yeah. But I do. I love it.
Which
I
is very good. So after two bids, it sold for $15. You know, a good deal. So then also John from the Retro Maccast, he covered a Color Classic 040 with an 040 upgrade and 2E card. Last time I checked this a few days ago, I think it hadn't sold. It was a buy it now. And it looks like it's unsold because they want $400 for it.
Ooh, that's...
Buy it now or you can make an offer. And usually it tells you if there's been offers, and it doesn't look like there's been offers, so maybe.
Yeah, I'm looking at the listing now, and it doesn't look like it comes with the 2E cards cable.
Yeah, it's missing.
Which is
that's
something
right.
really important to get if you get a 2E card, because there's that little Y cable that lets you hook up the external drive, so you get a 5 1/4-inch drive or chain of drives, and also the joystick. And the cable is sometimes as hard to come by as the 2E card.
So, and he had mentioned that was kind of an essential part.
Mm.
And then also, so then the next auction here was from Evan Koblenz, and it was an interesting book by Leslie Solomon and Stan Veit. I have a copy of this. It's called Getting Involved with Your Own Computer, A Guide for Beginners. This is also not sold because it's at $39.90. Buy it now. We discussed in last podcast that basically that you can find this book. I mean, it's reasonably rarer than a standard book, but you can find it fairly quickly through A-Books or the used market of Amazon for much cheaper. And
I like the Libris.
Yeah. And if you look at the show notes for last time, Evan told me about, it's checking different sites at one time. It is called, Ad All. And you said Libra? A Libris.
A Libris.
Yeah, so it'll check a Libris too. Biblio, a Libris, A-Books, Amazon. So you can do this one search and find it. The link did the search for that book. So you can find it for $4.70. That book did not sell, for $39.90. And lastly, my eBay auction is maybe sort of cheating, which I cheat again this episode. I didn't really do a particular item. I basically, for the sake of discussion, went into the vintage computing category and simply did a search for rare. It brought up like thousands of results. So, it just kind of shows you how often, even just in the vintage computing category, how often people use the term rare to describe things. So that made for some, good discussion. So bringing this into this show's auctions, I just want to mention again a great resource called the Collectors Weekly site. And I'll put a link in this show's show notes. Just basically, it's a nice site where you can do a quick search and see what the most watched items are in computers, the most watchers, and then I think the ones with the highest bids. So it's interesting to look at that. But first we'll go to Carrington.
I picked something that is not at all rare, and is another example of a book that you can find cheaper used through sites like A-Books and stuff. It's Doc's 1-Minute Encyclopedia of Nintendo Game Instructions. I went non-Apple on this choice.
Okay.
If, like me, you're a fan of 8-bit games, like the Nintendo, the NES and stuff, and you're more of a player than a collector, which is what I am when it comes to NES things, the easiest way to come across these games economically is to just buy the cartridges. Carts are available all over the place, and it's much more rare to find a complete box with instructions and things. And a book such as this one is about 320 pages or so, and it's basically the instructions and then some secrets and tips for 300 or so Nintendo games. So I love my copy. So it's great if you pick up a cartridge and you have no idea how to play a game. You now have the instructions. It's also a great way to browse through and see if games look like they would be fun to play. And then you can go online and pick yourself up like a $2 or $3 Nintendo cartridge that is now playable because you have this and a set of complete instructions. It's the kind of thing that's not rare at all. You can easily pick it up used for $4 or $5. It's frequently available in places. So maybe not this particular auction would be the way to go, unless you find it very convenient. But it's a book that I highly recommend if you like to play old NES games. Because it sort of turns an old NES into sort of a vintage version of a modern app store, where you have your iPad or your iPhone and you can just sort of dive in and pick up games for a couple of dollars, and for that kind of price it's worth trying something.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have the instructions for hundreds of games, then you can simply pick up the carts, which are themselves often available for just a couple of dollars.
Very cool. So, Michael, you go ahead. You know, I've heard of a Sword computer for such a long time, and I don't know anything about them. So when I saw your choice here.
Right. It's a Japanese company. They did sell in the U.S. And Sword is kind of a, it's not an acronym, but it's for software hardware. And the company kind of saw itself as offering everything. They didn't sell just computers. They also had printers and other hardware. They wanted to be a one-stop shop. And they kind of overreached. But this system is it's an unusual one, but it's probably their least interesting one. They had a portable called an M5 that is actually quite collectible. They had a 68,000 system that was interesting. This is a Z80 S100 based system.
Okay.
It's the M243 Mark IV, and the Mark IV was actually the bottom of the line for the 243. It's just a single 5.25-inch floppy. And the seller here is quite optimistic. He's got a $5,000 buy it now price on it. I think he should be extremely happy if somebody offers him a tenth of that. To me, it's a $100 or $200 system.
But pretty rare, you think? I mean,
it's pretty rare. This was a basic business machine. I know they sold into a lot of financial services firms and things like that. So they're out there, but they're rare. But again, rarity doesn't always translate into value. It's what people want.
This machine, it's a Japanese computer, but it was sold. This is like an American market computer.
This is an American version. It's got the ASCII keyboard and QWERTY keyboard, and it's for English language.
It's a really cool choice. I've never seen one of these before.
Like I said, I've heard of them over the years. To be honest, I think in passing, I always kind of thought it was an English computer. You know, that maybe it was something from England. That's why, you know, other than just hearing about them, I never really saw one. Are you familiar with these at all, Bruce? Do you have anything
heard,
like this?
I've heard the name. Maybe you're confusing this with the Torch, which was an English computer slightly earlier. But yeah, I've heard the name, but I've never been offered one and never been able to find one.
Swords and torches. I don't know about you guys, but I want to play Dungeons and Dragons right now.
Something interesting about the pictures, like here's a picture of the underside of the keyboard, and it looks like there's sort of like a melt mark, you know, as if a hot soldering iron was laid on it or something. Yeah. Do you see that? And then if you look at like the top of the keyboard, there's also a couple other sort of, they could just be chips, but they look like actually sort of a melt, something hot.
What's also interesting is it looks like the serial number was written in.
Oh, yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, it was. Made in Japan. 811-00700. I wonder if that has something to do with date code, as well as different mark.
Yeah, these were introduced in Japan in 82, and I think they came over to the U.S. in 83.
That's cool. It's got a neat form factor.
It kind of reminds me of a Heath machine, is what I want to say. Heath Zenith. All right, so our last category here, eBay auction, is me kind of cheating again. Not really, but I didn't pick a particular item. Michael's Sword probably will come up in my search here, and yes, it does. That basically what I did is I went into vintage computing category again and simply put it in order of pictures, which is kind of nice, and I did it as price plus shipping, highest first.
Okay.
That's all I'm doing. So basically we can look at the highest priced things in vintage computing, which is... What wins for right at this moment of recording is the K-Pro 2 at $35,000. But you do save with only $1 shipping. Oh, and he will accept a best offer, he or she. And then next you have a super rare IBM 5110 for a buy it now of $9,500 with free shipping. And then it goes down the line. You got a 5100 for $79.99.
For me, that number 2 appears first because being in Canada, the shipping is different.
Oh, yeah. Okay, right. So that's changing your results. Oh, that's interesting. Depending upon where you are, even in the United States, it might change. Possibly, as you get a lower price.
Yes, us Canadians get used to searching on eBay just for items that are willing to ship to our country.
Yeah. And, Michael, do you see the APF Imagination Machine?
Yeah, they knocked a couple of thousand off the price.
Yeah, that's the one that you had picked the last time around, I think, right?
Yes.
And then here's another 5110. Now, that's, at least from this small picture, there's a really nice-looking polymorphic system, but, you know, $69.99. And then here's the Sword Data General processor card for $5,000. My kids don't need to eat for next 6 months. I could swing that.
In this economy, you wonder, is this a sign of desperation?
Well, and on this show, there's been, this has come up a couple of times with like outrageously priced eBay items. And the discussion has, we've discussed about, you know, maybe this, some of these things could be a tactic too, where someone really doesn't want to sell it anyway. So what better way than to put an outrageous price, because then there's no chance of selling it. Yes, dear, I'll try to sell it, I promise.
Now, of course, there's the Apple One that sold in London at the auction house for $100,000+. Waz was talking about that when he was here. He was flown over there. They gave him a 2-hour warning. They said, we'll pay your way, business class, if you'll come to London and be here for this auction.
Uh-huh.
And his wife was flying back from London. And he just took his daughter, and they got on to the plane, and she landed after they had left. And they went over. And there's a YouTube video of Alan Lindell's interview of Waz about this. If you Google Waz, you'll find it. But it was interesting. He was in the room during the auction. I guess it helped raise the publicity and maybe help them get a better price. I don't know.
Oh, and I think so. That's what I would say. That had to have helped things, and okay. I would imagine maybe the person that bought it, maybe they were able to have Waz sign it. I mean, or sign something. I mean, why is there?
Probably, yeah, yeah. And in fact, that guy had bought that Apple One several months before on eBay for I don't know, $15,000-$20,000, then turned around and got it into this kind of auction where he realized he could make a lot more than on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a lesson for all you eBay sellers out there.
All right. I guess that'll wrap it up then. So nothing else? Anybody add anything?
No. Are we supposed to be doing that thing where we talk about other podcasts? I can't remember from the show notes again.
Yes. And, you know, I had put in last time I had tried something where I like asked everybody how old they were. And I kind of decided maybe that's just kind of awkward and not really necessary.
And,
and Bruce, you on your own, though. Yeah, put out how old you are.
And I guess I did technically too, talking about IBM in 1968. So
yeah, so
you do the math and say I'm 42.
I was officially the oldest person last time. So Bruce, you are 2 years older than I am.
Yeah, we're all. It's funny.
We're all around the same. Yeah,
we're all in the 40s. I'm turning 49 on Monday.
Nice.
Oh, happy birthday!
Thank you.
I know a lot of people with birthdays around now. People really do get busy in the spring.
But Bruce, you know, I don't want to be a downer, but it's all going to be downhill from there. I'm sorry.
If you're picking up speed, it's all good.
Well, guys, everyone, thank you very much again for being on the show. And it's always my pleasure to have each of you on and to make this possible. This show has become a really exciting, great thing in my life, no matter how long it takes to edit. So I hope you all return, you know, next time. You know, the next rotation. I'd like to thank the panelists of Show 6 once again. First, there was Carrington Vanston, who hosts 1 Megahertz, the Apple II podcast, and Michael Nadeau, author of Collectible Microcomputers, and he also writes the Classic Tech blog, as well as Bruce Damer, curator of the Digibarn Computer Museum. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Check the show notes for all the links that were discussed. Please check out my other two podcasts, the Classic Computing Video Podcast and Stan Veed's History of the Personal Computer Audiobook Podcast. All three of my podcasts can be subscribed to through iTunes. Please help me out by leaving a review in the iTunes store. There's also a link on every podcast page where you can download any podcast directly. You can also help support the shows by donating through PayPal. A link is at the bottom of the show notes page. Plus, you can support the shows by using my Amazon.com links for books mentioned and with the search box. Read my blog and follow everything I'm doing at classiccomputing.com.